Today is Thursday, the 22nd of January, and this is the World Socialist Website. Twilight at the Met: Capitalism's Contempt for Culture, by Fred Mazellis and David North. The Metropolitan Opera, for generations the stage on which the greatest dramatic tragedies have been performed, now finds itself the setting for one that is all too real. The largest performing arts organization in the United States is staring into the abyss. The company's announcement this week of yet another round of devastating cutbacks exposes with brutal clarity the incapacity of American capitalism to sustain even its most celebrated cultural institutions. What is unfolding at the Met is not merely a financial crisis. It is a cultural execution in slow motion and a scathing indictment of a system that has long since abandoned any pretense of nurturing the higher aspirations of human civilization. The figures speak for themselves. The company has hemorrhaged $120 million from its endowment over just 3 years, leaving a mere $217.5 million, barely two-thirds of its annual $330 million operating budget. 22 administrative positions will be eliminated. Executives will absorb salary cuts between 4 and 15%. The 2026-27 season will offer a pathetic 17 productions, down from 25 before the pandemic. The most damning of all, the Met is now contemplating the sale of its iconic Marc Chagall murals, The Triumph of Music and The Sources of Music, commissioned for the Opera House's opening at Lincoln Center in 1966, and valued at $55 million. Management, acutely aware that removing these masterworks would be tantamount to a declaration of bankruptcy, is desperately stipulating that any buyer must leave them hanging in the grand tier. The murals would remain, but with a plaque commemorating their new owner as a grotesque visual reminder of institutional humiliation. To grasp the enormity of this collapse, one must understand what the Metropolitan Opera once represented. Founded in 1883, the Met rapidly became the premier opera house in the Western Hemisphere and one of the greatest in the world. For over a century, virtually every legendary voice in opera graced its stage. Caruso, whose golden tenor made him a household name across America. Maria Callas, the volcanic dramatic soprano who redefined operatic acting. Kirsten Flagstad, Lauritz Melchior, Rosa Poncel, Renata Tebaldi, Jussi Björling and Birgit Nielsen, among many others. The roster reads like a pantheon of vocal immortals. For decades, the Met brought opera into millions of American homes through its legendary Saturday afternoon radio broadcasts, which began in 1931. These weekly transmissions, sponsored for years by Texaco, created an enormous national audience for an art form that might otherwise have remained the exclusive province of the wealthy. Families gathered around their radios to hear live performances from the Met stage. Opera was not an elitist curiosity. It was a vital part of American cultural life. Caruso and Callas were not obscure names known only to connoisseurs. They were celebrities whose fame rivaled that of film stars. Under the management of Rudolf Bing, who led the company from 1950 to 1972, the Metropolitan Opera achieved historic significance in ways that extended beyond artistic excellence. Bing, though he fastidiously avoided public political pronouncements, integrated the company in 1955 by hiring the great African-American contralto Marian Anderson. 6 years later, Leontine Price made her debut in Verdi's Il Trovatore to a 42-minute standing ovation, one of the most celebrated moments in operatic history. Price, Grace Bunbury, George Shirley, Shirley Verrett, and others of their generation found at the Met a stage worthy of their extraordinary talents. The Opera House, for all its dependence on wealthy patrons, served as a vehicle for transcendent artistry that spoke to something universal in the human experience. In 1966, the Metropolitan moved to its magnificent new home at the Lincoln Center for the Performing Arts, a complex conceived as the nation's premier venue for the performing arts. The new Met, with its soaring travertine arches and its Chagall murals, was intended as a monument to American cultural ambition. But the unveiling of the new Opera House coincided with a critical turn in the fortunes of American capitalism. As was soon to become clear, 1966 was the high watermark of American liberalism. What has happened since then? The growing political reaction that has engulfed American society over the past half century has taken a devastating toll on culture. The assault on living standards, the decimation of public education, the relentless coarsening of public life, all have contributed to a growing indifference toward the arts. Opera, once accessible to a broad audience, became the preserve of an ever narrower stratum of the wealthy. Ticket prices at the Met soared to staggering heights, $300, $400, $500, and more for decent seats, placing attendance beyond the reach of ordinary New Yorkers. The art form that had once entered millions of homes through the radio increasingly retreated behind walls of exclusivity. Yet even the patronage of the rich has proven insufficient. The Met, like opera houses throughout history, has always depended on the largesse of wealthy donors. But the American ruling class, bloated with wealth beyond all historical precedent, has demonstrated a bottomless contempt for sustaining the cultural heritage of humanity. New York City, the world capital of financialized capitalism, home to the Wall Street banks and hedge funds that have looted trillions from society and presided over levels of inequality that almost defy comprehension, cannot apparently muster the resources to support its own opera company. Berlin maintains three opera houses. Vienna, Milan, Paris, Munich, and London sustain thriving companies with substantial public funding. The difference is not that American capitalism lacks the resources. It is that American capitalism, long before Trump, became the spearhead of global social counter-revolution. And now the Met has descended to begging for alms from the blood-soaked Saudi monarchy. The deal announced months ago would see Met Productions touring to Saudi Arabia annually for 8 years in exchange for $200 million. Let us be clear about what this represents. The Metropolitan Opera, one of the most storied cultural institutions in the world, has agreed to serve as a propaganda vehicle for an authoritarian regime implicated in the assassination and dismemberment of journalist Jamal Khashoggi, in the starvation and slaughter of tens of thousands in Yemen, in the systematic repression of women and dissidents. General Manager Peter Gelb, defending this squalid arrangement, told the New York Times with breathtaking cynicism, quote, "All the democratic governments that I know of are engaged in business with Saudi Arabia. I have to put the survival of the institution of the Met first. I don't operate the Met according to my personal feelings on every issue," end quote. This from the same Peter Gelb who transformed the Met into a virtual propaganda outlet for the imperialist proxy war in Ukraine, who fired the world-renowned soprano Anna Netrebko because while she condemned the invasion of Ukraine, she declined to denounce Putin by name, a distinction Gelb found unacceptable. Gelb's personal feelings align perfectly with the policy imperatives of dominant sections of the American ruling class. When it comes to Russia, he is a moralist. When it comes to Saudi Arabia and its cash, he is a pragmatist. The hypocrisy is nauseating. Even this Faustian bargain now hangs in doubt. Quote, I understand the Saudis have had to recalibrate their budgets because of their own economic concerns, Gelb admitted to the Times. Quote, I've been assured it's going to go forward, but we have been waiting for some time, end quote. The Met has sold its dignity and may not even collect the payment. The Opera House is also pursuing the sale of its naming rights, following the degrading example of its Lincoln Center neighbours. Philharmonic Hall became Avery Fisher Hall and is now Geffen Hall after the billionaire media executive donated $100 million. The New York State Theatre was rechristened the David A. Koch Theatre, honouring the right-wing billionaire whose fortune helped fund the dismantling of environmental protections and the assault on workers' rights. The world-famous Metropolitan Opera, which once seemed immune to such indignity, is now on the auction block. The crisis at the Met recalls the 2013-2014 assault on the Detroit Institute of Arts during that city's bankruptcy, when emergency manager Kevin Orr sought to appraise and potentially sell the museum's $20 billion art collection to pay creditors. The same logic is at work. The cultural heritage of humanity is to be liquidated to satisfy the demands of capital. This broader assault on culture now extends to the highest levels of the American state. The Kennedy Center has been thrown into turmoil since Trump was named chairman of its board in February 2025. Artists across genres, from Hamilton to the Martha Graham Dance Company to the Washington National Opera, have cancelled appearances, refusing to perform at a venue transformed into a vehicle for the glorification of a would-be dictator. The Trump administration has threatened the Smithsonian Institution with funding cuts if it does not submit to ideological demands. The proposed budget eliminates funding entirely for institutions, including the Anacostia Community Museum and the National Museum of the American Latino. The defense of culture cannot be entrusted to the ruling class, which has demonstrated its utter indifference to sustaining the artistic achievements of civilization. It cannot be entrusted to administrators like Gelb, who, during the height of the COVID pandemic, collected nearly $1.4 million annually while stagehands and chorus members were thrown out of work. The working class, the inheritor of all that is progressive in human civilization, is the only social force capable of defending the cultural heritage of humanity. The Achilles heel of American artistic institutions has always been their dependence on private donors, on the whims of the wealthy. But art is not a charitable indulgence. It is an indispensable element of human existence. Society must guarantee the resources necessary for its flourishing. That this elementary truth is even contested exposes the barbarism of a system that subordinates every human need to private accumulation. The fate of art is inextricably bound up with the struggle for socialism and the reorganization of society's resources in the interests of all humanity. Davos World Economic Forum dominated by Trump's threats over Greenland, by Andre Damon. The World Economic Forum, which opened Monday in Davos, Switzerland, was dominated by the deepening rift between the United States and the European powers over US President Donald Trump's efforts to take control of Greenland. By the end of Wednesday evening, Trump had announced that he would walk back his earlier threats to annex Greenland by military force or impose tariffs against European states in exchange for what he called an agreement over control of the territory. Greenland is an autonomous territory of Denmark, a founding member of the NATO alliance. Trump met with NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte on Wednesday and announced the framework of a future deal, though the precise terms remain unclear and disputed. The New York Times reported citing unnamed senior officials familiar with the discussions, that NATO military officers discussed, quote, a compromise in which Denmark would give the United States sovereignty over small pockets of Greenlandic land where the United States could build military bases, end quote. Two officials compared the proposal to Britain's sovereign base areas in Cyprus. The Telegraph said the framework would allow the US to, quote, perform military operations, intelligence and training, end quote, without seeking permission from Denmark, an arrangement similar to the US military's control of Guantanamo Bay in Cuba. Danish officials rejected the characterization that any real agreement had been reached. Danish Foreign Minister Lars Løkke Rasmussen told public broadcaster DR that US ownership of Greenland remains a red line for Denmark. Sascha Fax, a member of the Danish Parliament, told Sky News that the purported deal was not real, adding, quote, it's two men who have had a conversation. It's definitely not a deal, end quote. Rutte himself told Fox News that the question of whether Greenland would remain under Danish control, quote, did not come up, end quote, in his talks with Trump. Trump withdrew tariff threats against eight European countries following the announcement, sending stock markets sharply higher after the S&P 500 had posted its worst day since October on Tuesday. The crisis at Davos exposed the advanced state of disintegration of the transatlantic alliance. Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney, speaking from the forum on Tuesday, delivered a stark assessment of the global situation. Quote, let me be direct. We are in the midst of a rupture, not a transition, Carney declared. He warned that, quote, the rules-based order is fading, end quote, and invoked the ancient Greek historian Thucydides. Quote, the strong do what they can, and the weak suffer what they must, end quote. Carney received a standing ovation from the audience, while Trump's address was met with tepid applause. French President Emmanuel Macron denounced the Trump administration's trade strategy as an effort to, quote, weaken and subordinate Europe, end quote. The depth of the rift between the US and Europe was illustrated by European Central Bank President Christine Lagarde, who walked out of a dinner during a speech by US Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick that was critical of European economic policies. Whatever the final form of the arrangement, it represents an expansion of US military control over the Arctic. In his address to the forum, Trump framed his efforts to control Greenland within the context of the US conflict with Russia and China. Quote, Greenland is a vast, almost entirely uninhabited and underdeveloped territory sitting undefended in a key strategic location between the United States, Russia, and China, end quote. Doubling down on this bizarre geography, Greenland is 5,000 miles or 8,000 kilometres from China, he added, quote, that's exactly where it is, right smack in the middle, end quote. While walking back his threat to use military force, Trump made clear he would use economic coercion to achieve his aims. Quote, you can say yes and we will be very appreciative, he declared, or you can say no and we will remember, end quote. The Trump administration's drive to seize control of Greenland is part of a broader effort to reorganize the Western Hemisphere under direct US domination. The administration views the consolidation of American power over its near abroad as essential for projecting power against American imperialism's principal rival, China. Canada and Greenland, with their vast mineral resources, energy deposits, and access to Arctic seaways, are critical to this effort, as is the Panama Canal. This strategy of hemispheric consolidation aims to secure a continental resource base for great power conflict. Greenland's strategic value has grown as climate change transforms the Arctic. The Northwest Passage, once impassable for most of the year, is becoming increasingly navigable, offering a shipping route that cuts thousands of miles and weeks of transit time from journeys between Asia and the Atlantic. Control of the Arctic waters and the territories that border them has emerged as a central preoccupation of all the major imperialist powers. The Arctic has become a zone of intensifying militarization. The United States maintains the Pituffik Space Base, formerly known as Thule Air Base, in northern Greenland, its northernmost military installation. The base houses critical missile defense and early warning systems that would provide minutes of additional warning time in the event of a nuclear exchange with Russia or China. Trump has spoken repeatedly of his Golden Dome missile defense system, for which Greenland's position would be invaluable. The high Arctic territory sits astride the shortest flight paths between the continental United States and both Russia and China, making it irreplaceable for both offensive and defensive military operations. Beyond its strategic location, Greenland contains enormous deposits of rare earth minerals essential for advanced technology and weapon systems, as well as uranium and substantial oil reserves beneath its continental shelf. The gathering of the world's financial oligarchy at Davos took place against the backdrop of the staggering growth of billionaire wealth documented in the Oxfam report, Resisting the Rule of the Rich, released to coincide with the forum. The report found that billionaire wealth grew at 3 times the rate of the previous 5 years, with the 12 richest individuals on Earth now possessing more wealth than the poorest half of humanity combined. The crisis over Greenland sent investors fleeing toward safe haven assets. Gold prices surged to record highs as precious metals registered their sharpest gains in months. The flight to gold and other stores of value reflects the deep unease within financial markets over the trajectory of the great power relations and the growing risk of a broader conflict. The surge in precious metals is a barometer of capitalist instability, indicating that sections of the ruling class see in the current crisis the harbinger of something far worse. Whatever the temporary resolution of the standoff over Greenland, the underlying trajectory is toward mounting conflict between the US and Europe, in which American imperialism will be increasingly impelled to rely on its one main advantage, military force. The eruption of this crisis at the premier gathering of the global capitalist elite exposes a crisis of the entire post-World War II international order. Neither Trump's America First nationalism nor the European bourgeoisie's response offers any way forward for the working class. Both represent factions of a ruling class that is incapable of resolving its conflicts through any other means than violence, economic warfare, and ultimately, military confrontation. Online meeting Sunday, the New York nurses' strike and the fight against the financial oligarchy. The World Socialist website, WSWS, will host an online meeting in support of the 15,000 striking New York workers at 3 p.m. EST on Sunday, January 25. Please see this article in the World Socialist website to register for the meeting. The issues nurses are fighting against, inadequate staffing ratios, substandard pay and benefits, are part of a corporate attack on public health. At the federal level, Trump's Health and Human Services Secretary, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., is suppressing medical science and attacking vaccinations, leading to the resurgence of previously suppressed or eliminated diseases such as measles and hepatitis. The nurses' strike, located in the center of world finance, is part of a broader movement of the working class, whose logic culminates in a national and international movement against oligarchy and dictatorship. On Friday, Workers in Minneapolis will conduct a general strike against the occupation of the city by ICE agents, who have already killed one person, Renee Nicole Good. The World Socialist website welcomes this development and calls for the expansion of such actions to New York City and across America. An upcoming strike by 31,000 West Coast nurses, strike votes by teachers in Los Angeles and academic workers at the University of California, as well as a contract expiring next month for 30,000 oil refinery workers, shows the potential for a broader movement in which the demands of every workplace coalesce into a class movement aimed at the entrenched privileges of the capitalist elite. To prepare such action, workers should form broad, democratic, rank-and-file organizations to link up their struggles and mobilize in opposition to the entire political establishment. Register now to attend the public meeting, support the striking nurses, and organize a fight for workers' control of society. For these articles and more on workers' struggles, both nationally and internationally, and the nurses' strike, visit wsws.org. This has been Jenny Campbell.
The World Socialist website is published by the International Committee of the Fourth International, the ICFI, the leadership of the World Socialist Movement, the Fourth International founded by Leon Trotsky in 1938. The World Socialist website relies entirely on the donations of readers and listeners for financial support. To give to the WSWS or to set up a regular monthly contribution, go to wsws.org/donate. We urge our listeners to join the International Committee of the Fourth International and one of its affiliated political parties and take up the struggle for socialism.